Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming. This is going to be the what's entitled the Web Application Comicalization and Encoding and Transcoding Attacks. And this should be a really fun talk. I'm just here to introduce Arian Evans. And Arian is the Director of Operations at Y-Hat. But what that means is Arian probably has the toughest job in all of web application security, and which tends to make him a little crazy at times. So his job is to manage probably what is the largest web application security team who does nothing but hack the world's largest websites and lots of them all at the same time. So while you'll see out there, you see many white papers in the industry, very technical on encoding attacks and things like that, this research here, the content that he's put together is directly from real-world experience on real-world websites and how to make the attacks that, we're all too familiar with now that seem to be getting more and more difficult out there, but they will work if you encode them in the right ways and on publicly facing websites and defeat most any security measure in place. So without further introduction, please give a hand to Arian Evans.
I haven't even tried this. Okay. Can everyone hear me? Okay. I can't see any of you right now. So let's see where we go with this. Jeremiah Grossman, we have a slide here. He's not entirely thrilled about that. That's why I went ahead and added this slide. For those of you who can't see me up here, I think with the light, you probably can, but nonetheless, I have a picture of me. Someone asked me last night, they go, wow, so that's what you look like 10 years ago. This was actually 4 months ago. I don't know what I've been doing with the diet, but nonetheless. I have some obligatory slides about why that's what I work for. I want to touch base quickly on this. We're going to cover today one of two subject categories while that light is bright. So the two subject categories that are going to be covered today, Jeremiah has a presentation this afternoon where we're going to talk about semantic issues, or he's going to talk about them. Today, we're going to talk about syntax issues, and I break these down. And a quick distinction for those of you, and most of you in this room, because it's the Black Hat crowd, are probably very familiar with this. But I want to give a high-level overview. There's a lot of verbiage out there about web AppSec vulnerabilities and how to put them in different bit buckets. So really quickly, very simply, one category I call syntax issues, which are, any form of argument. That's what we think of as the hacker typing in evil code, basically forking a code path so an interpreter does something new. The second class, which are normally design issues, I call semantic. And semantic issues are what my mother can do with the web browser when she's trying to sell something online and finds a way to manipulate an integer, a parameter, etc. Basically, there's an intended dialogue with the user, and there's ways to subvert that intended dialogue. Those are semantic. There's nothing technical about them at all. So today's discussion is going to focus on syntax attacks. Everything I'm going to talk about encoding, you could encode semantic attacks, but it's really not going to be very useful for you. What is going to be important here is you can encode syntax arguments to bypass IDS, IPS, WAFs, etc. And we're going to be short on time here, so I'm going to skip some slides. I'm going to try to run through to do some demos and blast Q&A. The last group ran over, so I'm going to power through. If at any point I'm not explaining well, raise your hand. I won't see you anyway. And canonicalization issues, they exist because of emergent behaviors. Scanners do not identify them. Now, any form of automation could identify these things. It becomes exponentially complex, but any form of automation could identify these things. It has been my experience that nothing today does any effective work at identifying these in terms of automation, except for I work on an automation platform that does a little bit of this. But WAFs, IDS, IPS, validation controls ignore these. Now, many of the vendors will tell you we actually do interpret different encoded data. We understand transcodings. We drop things that aren't valid. They all have the same story. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. That makes sense. You absolutely should. If you can't canonicalize it properly, if you can't do this or that, then you should drop it. In my experience in the real world, though, they completely ignore it. So I don't know what they actually do and how they do it, but they all tell the same story. And from what I've seen, none of them do anything. In fact, I called out on the list late last year, early this year, IBM's Preventia, their IPS solution, had all these claims for what they did for web AppSec. And they talked about canonicalization, data encoding, etc. And so I called them out. I said, I don't think you can do any of this, especially at wire speed. I don't think it's possible. The product owner actually came on the list and said, you know what, you're right. We don't do any of that. It was completely a marketing thing. We've since taken it off our, you know, our web pages and taken it out of our marketing literature. You know, we're working on this. It's a tough problem. Yeah, so they were actually very cool about it. Black cats are using these in the wild. And we're going to talk about that as well. This is actually the most interesting. So I want to, even though I can't see any of you, I'm curious what the audience is. I got blindsided at RSA because I built a presentation which I thought was appropriate for RSA level, and I turned out to have like the most technical audience ever at RSA. So in terms of who's here today, how many people are like CISOs or information security management? Have any management types here? Okay. Software developers. Do any of you actually write code for a living? Okay, you're in the wrong room. No. Penetration testers or hackers. Oh. Okay. So how many consultants do we have? I know we have some okay. Do we have any product vendors? Okay, there's one in here. Is there anybody here that's still intoxicated? Wow, that is like so many less hands than happens in Black Hat Amsterdam. You normally get about half the room. They actually schedule the Microsoft party here much smarter. They do it after night. Sometimes in Amsterdam, they do it in the middle of the conference. It has very interesting results. So why do you care about these attacks? You're probably here wondering this right now since you're here listening to me. Hopefully you have an answer. And my answer is because they're being used in the wild. This is one of the more fun examples, but it's actually not the best example. Someone brought this up last night, and a person accused me of basically a limited subset of people understanding this issue. The thing is while a lot of people haven't played with this, the Black Hats have been. And you can go back and look. This is documented in a couple places online. One of the first attacks using double encoding, and by double encode, well, we'll get into that, but one of the first attacks in the wild is in 2004. It's in December of 2004. Attackers used up to four varieties of double encoded attacks against SunGard and SunTrust Bank. So they went after SunGard and they went after SunTrust Bank, and they were targeting login forms, any pages they could. It was actually very interesting. So then that kind of dropped off. I didn't see many interesting attacks in the wild until February of this year. And in February of this year, I started seeing attackers using a trick, and this really pissed me off because we have some really cool tests in the platform I work on to find blind SQL injection and do data tainting, etc. And you know, it's like proprietary knowledge, etc. Right? And all of a sudden, attackers are using this in the wild, and they're actually writing bots. And as of April, and I don't know what the current stats are because I'm lazy, but there were 11,000 websites that were compromised by April. I think total number of web pages was in the... Jeremiah just said 1.5 million. I saw like 680-some thousand. Absolutely brilliant. They've added in functions for many different databases. And so anyway, why do you care about it? Because it is actually going on in the wild. So what in the world are these things? So encoded and obfuscated attacks have been around since 1991. I know probably a lot of you weren't doing a lot on the web in 1991, but these have been around for a long time. Web applications are growing larger and more complex. This leads into the part about this. So internationalization leads to transcoding. We're going to talk about that. Gluing applications together and using third-party libraries also leads to these issues. So normal attacks like cross-site scripting and SQL injection may be encoded and transcoded in very complex and unusual ways as a result of these emergent behaviors. So long and short, you may not know what your apps are doing with strangely encoded data. In fact, you may not even know that data is encoded. Here's a really bad timeline that I've wired up to some sort of effects that I don't understand how to use in Keynote. So nonetheless, my point in this is I was breaking down a couple things. And the most interesting thing is, you know, attacks show up in 91. We get polymorphism. We get DAME, which is automated creation toolkits. Somebody last night actually told me that there's an attack generation tool that's out there on the web for some of what I'm going to talk about today in a more limited subset. Actually, I started writing tools in 2004 in JavaScript and then in Java, and so did one of my peers and one of my ex-colleagues has continued this work, and we made a formal tool since 2005. When you download this presentation that I'm going to give to Black Hat, I'm going to put the link in. I called him yesterday and I had him re-upload this tool because nobody's put out a tool like this yet. So it's called HT Mangle, and it emerged from what we were doing in 2005. Anyway, you'll have a link at the end in references, and so you can download and play with that. It's absolutely very cool. He's done some neat work since then, but this started with hard drive viruses, and this evolved. The funny thing was, is I saw this all this stuff of canonicalization and emergent data, and I saw this happen with hard drives. You know, and they got into encoding, they got into, you know, creating envelopes to stuff things in. And then this evolved in network attacks, and K2 came out with a utility called AD Mutate, if I recall correctly, and K2's AD Mutate would create different encodings, different non-canonicalized formats of network attacks. So I saw this, and I'm not very smart, so I'd see all this going on, I'd be like, oh wow, those people are like really crazy over there in like hard drive virus space and network space. And I had my web apps, and I had one particular web application that was International Wires at the time. This is around the turn of the century. And my International Wires app would get the most bizarre attacks from China and Russia. Actually, my most interesting attacks came from a bank in Russia. We traced back their net block. I really don't know what they were doing with their net block, or a whole different funding model for that bank than we have here in the U.S. But anyway, I would see these things come in, and I just didn't get them. And finally, we started playing around and realized that these same concepts for canonicalization exist today. So why would your software be vulnerable to canonicalization or encoding attacks? So there's some very simple answers. Actually, I have some very strong guesses, and I'll talk about this again at the end. When I talk about solutions, because I really don't have many, I'm going to make some up. But why do these happen? Well, I see over and over again, apps get bolted together. And there were a lot of pen testers in the room, probably a lot of you over the years. You test app A and you test app B, and they have completely different I/O models. You know, data that's saved for app A and data that's saved for app B. They test out, they're pretty fine, they're pretty robust, the ACLs are cool, the company bolts them together. And all of a sudden you've got shared data sources, shared data paths, and that data isn't safe anymore. Internationalization. One of the examples I'm going to get into is I'm going to talk about a dating site that I found that supported a lot of international languages, and one was Hebrew. And the cool thing about dating is you want to allow people from all different parts of the world to talk to each other, right? So you normalize the data, and I'm seeing more and more of this. So internationalization requires developers to transcode by design. Developers actually use encodings for type safety. And one of the funniest conversations we had about this subject was I was actually arguing with some people at White Hat about, would you ever see a case where you double encode with the exact same data encoding stream. And in this case, we're talking about Base64. We all know Base64, right? Would you ever see that in the web, passed around a URI? Or name value pair? And would you ever see Base64 FS2, file system safe, Base64? It's an alternate encoding. And people were saying, no, these are silly. You know, these tests probably don't make sense. And I'm like, no, actually, I've seen this out there. I know people use it. And about that time, one of our developers across the way, behind our whole plots on the cube farm, stood up, and he goes, by the way, guys, I just had to implement this. You know, I actually just used this exact same form of double encoding. And we were like, what in the world would you use that for? And it turned out, please don't tell anyone this is actually kind of a secret, but part of our integration with our technology to talk back into web application firewalls actually required us to do some crazy encoding to pass around certain types of data and strings in a way that is kind of scary. Now, the way we're doing it is completely benign and safe, but it doesn't mean it is in most apps, and in most cases, it's not. So developers actually use these for type safety. In this case, we were normalizing data to pass it around so a web app firewall could snag it and be completely safe, so you couldn't attack a web app firewall through the data we're passing it. Developers use third-party, and this is probably the most guilty thing I see. I'm going to bring up some stats here in a minute on these. But developers more and more love to wire in open source, third-party, etc. You know, could be Python, could be PHP. It's usually PHP stuff, which is kind of dirty and nasty code. But they wire in, you know, libraries for one or two or three functions, and they often don't know what the other 37 functions that library does are actually doing. And This is common in scopes of work. When you go to do like pen testing, black box, sometimes we'll find these things. But in black box, we often don't know where to target and look for these things. And even better, when we do white box, when we do source code review or threat modeling, they usually don't tell us about these, and oftentimes, they don't include the third-party framework. When we're doing a source code review, we don't look at Struts, we don't look at Hibernate, we don't look at Spring, you know. We don't go into these third-party frameworks, and that's where these things occur. So how do these attacks work? All right. They're really simple. You came here probably expecting something sexy and exciting, and it's really not. Luckily for me, because if it were, I wouldn't probably be doing very good with this presentation. So this is very simple. Pick your target. What do I mean by that? I mean, pick a syntax attack. And you know, earlier I talked about syntax versus semantic attack. Take your cross-site scripting. Take your control character injection for operating systems, for the protocol, HTTP, whatever you want. Pick a syntax attack. And the second thing is identify your target parser. And I thought about enumerating on this, but I got kind of reamed at RSA for doing this. And I had all these cool network diagrams. And if we get to the end and people would just go, I didn't follow anything here and I need big pictures, I've got some cool network diagrams. But basically, all I did was map out and go, look, there's all these parsers and interpreters involved in a dialogue in an application. From your web browser, your victim's web browser, to the web server, all the way through. There's a round trip, and I'll cover what some of these are. But you need to pick a specific target parser. And most of us, when we do black box testing, don't think enough about that. We think about our cool and sexy attack and how to get it in there. Or we think about a weakness, like insufficient authorization. How do I bypass authorization and get Rob to see Sally's report, blah, 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 right? These type of attacks require a little more thinking than that, and we just need to think about what is our target parser, and once we figure that out, then we need to go research encodings. I mean, I'll go to search engines, and I'll pull down documentation for databases, whatever. There are so many encoding types, and I can't cover them for every possible parser and interpreter here. That would be impossible. And I don't know what you're going to run into, but you're going to have to go research them. That's really simple. Once you find an interpreter that you're going to target, go look what encodings it supports. Identify char sets, code pages, and encoding types. And then, the cool part, identify every intermediary interpreter. Whatever you're targeting could be the database, could be an asynchronous message queue. There's going to be intermediary interpreters between you or between your victim and that final parser that you're targeting. Those intermediary interpreters will play a role here. So I actually got this brought up. I was talking to Mozilla folks recently, and actually the Microsoft, I think some of them are here actually, but I was talking to someone I think on the IE8 team, and they were telling me about all this cool and sexy work that they're doing to like get rid of this stuff in the browser. And they're actually doing some cool things, right? So cross-site scripting is going away. You know, HTTP response splitting, now that's going away. And some people are trying to fix it server-side, but they're like, hey, the browsers, they're not going to pass this stuff anymore. And I was like, oh, this sucks. Because like, if that comes out, like right about the time I'm going to talk at Black Hat, then it's going to be like, well, here's some interesting things. They don't work anymore. By the way, you know, peace. So the cool thing is actually all these attacks work very well, and they actually work more reliably. And I didn't even think this through until I started playing with newer browsers. But as you encode these in ways I'm going to show you, by encoding these in ways apps will canonicalize, it actually increases the reliability in modern browsers. And they can't interpret it and filter them out. So if you have a secure browser or anything new, you'll actually do better. So for my demos, because I'm really scared and my demos weren't working this morning and I was freaked out, and that's why I was pouring sweat when I walked in here, it turned out that I found out my demo app doesn't like going to localhost. It wants a hard-coded IP. Don't ask why. So anyway, I was kind of freaked out, and I'm going to use IE6 because IE6 will interpret absolutely anything. But you'll find out many of these examples will actually work across any modern browser. So that said, how am I doing on time?
20 minutes.
Left?
If you want to save 10 for a question, yeah. It's 10:30.
Okay, we're going to... I'm going to have to rip through this. So, session premise, take attacks, encode them. We're going to skip session goals. We're going to skip objectives because... Snapshot. Now, I can you guys read this? Is this possible on the screen? This is actually pages long. So I actually have real hard world math. This is based upon roughly 672 or 76 mostly production web applications at the time I took this snapshot. So people always ask me, like, where do these attacks work? How common are they? And I, you know, these are not going to be your bread and butter that you find across an application. If you take these attacks and leverage them, you're not going to find them on every input field. Absolutely, these are going to be edge cases. And I have very clear reasons for that I'll talk about at the end. We'll cover in Q&A. They're going to be edge cases, but they're usually going to be an interesting functionality. And even though there's edge cases, there's a whole hell of a lot of edge cases. And that's the most bizarre thing. So you can look up here, and most of these don't have a description, and in some cases we had to sanitize them because the descriptions were not appropriate for general consumption. But you can see where we break these down, and all these are really interesting encoding types and variants. We've got double and triple encodings. I've got functions native to different interpreters that I'll take a function for an interpreter like a database or an LDAP engine, excuse me, and I'll use that to build up other types of attacks and then encode that. And so you can see through here, you know, you'll have some that are in the 90s, some are in the 7, 8, 9, 10, but we continue to find these all over the places. So you can say they're edge cases, but what we've been learning more and more is even though they're edge cases, there's a whole heck of a lot of edge cases. All right. Clearly, I haven't mastered this thing. So, attack targets. All right. Attack targets. So, what do I mean by that? What are your interpreters you're targeting? Like I mentioned earlier, pick, it could be a web browser, it could be a web server, could be a framework parser. One of my favorites over the years is .NET's framework. There's interpreters that work there, and there's filters for like anti-XSS, and you've got response splitting for HTTP response splitting. You've got a cool things. Pick your target. Could be query language interpreter. It could be Hibernate. Has HQL. So Hibernate has its own query language. We all know SQL injection, structured query language. What are your dependencies? Along the way there, you're going to have intermediary interpreters. So on the way to your final interpreter, if you're trying to attack the .NET framework itself, if you're trying to do SQL injection, that's fine. Along the way, you're going to have intermediary interpreters. They're going to be commonly web servers. iPlanet's a good one. Zeus is a good one. You're going to have app servers. Bia, Domino. Domino is one of my favorites over the years. Domino tends to do a lot of canonicalization, especially when people wire it together with a lot of libraries that come with different Java frameworks. Database engines. Informix is pretty cool. Microsoft SQL servers, absolutely brilliant to attack. DB2 is getting more functionality. And they've actually, when you start with MySQL 5, when you get into MySQL 5, when they add stored procedural logic, you'll actually find a lot of new char function interpretation. I found asynchronous message queues that do bizarre XML interpretation. So you have these intermediary interpreters, and along the way, they'll interpret different types of data, sometimes, well, in these edge cases, in layers that you wouldn't expect. So last night, someone actually called me out. They go, so basically you're going to talk about URL encoding? And yeah, I mean, that's what we're going to cover today. Hopefully you're not bored by that. But literally, hex, you know, URI escaping. Pretty boring, right? Most modern browsers escape meta characters, but you can actually encode every character, which is pretty simple. You can actually layer it, but you can put it together with other examples. So you've got hex URI. You've got the same examples for entity encoding. You've got all your C syntax type encoding in various different formats. You've got decimal encoding. You've got octal encoding, which I don't even cover here. You've got UTF-7 encoding, which we may get into at the end if we have time for demos, which I don't think since the last thing ran over we'll get into. You've got UTF-7, UTF-16. There's so many more formats. You probably all know RSnake's website that has different encoding types. You've got Unicode, International Code Page Transcoding, so we're going to get into that as well. You've got malformed encoding, so a lot of times you can take, you know, 7-bit encodings and you can use high bits and malform them. They'll still be interpreted. You've got in the Unicode formats, actually, I'm going to talk about international languages. I'm not going to have time today to even go into examples, but if we look back last year, the U.S. CERT issued an advisory on half-width and full-width encodings can bypass intrusion detection systems. And I was like, well, no kidding. Like, who interprets that in HTTP, right? So I thought, that's a pretty stupid advisory. But what they didn't even cover is all the different full-width encodings, and it's actually getting worse. More and more new app servers and engines are interpreting more and more variants of full-width encodings, which are just longer and bigger and bigger. So every time we add a new full-width encoding, we find engines that actually interpret it.
What about
and char functions. So what are your targets? Well, we've got user agent execution. We've got server-side targets. Basically, any syntax attack that you want, you can pick that. You can leverage these. How are we doing on time?
25.
So a basic example would look like this. I've got my retirement fund, and I want to put in a simple script alert, right? This is pretty boring, and we all know how this works. I've got a simple script alert, and in this particular case, they're filtering out. It could be script tags. It could be a JavaScript directive. So what do? Your URI escaped the whole thing. It actually was not that long ago. We're talking 3-4 years ago that some web app firewalls wouldn't even properly canonicalize URI escaping if your URI escaped every character. They look for meta characters, et cetera. They all do that today. So this is pretty boring. You're like, okay, yeah, your eye escaping, I get it. Right? So you get to request response pairing. How does this work? Well, the web app server unescapes the hex URI encoding. It's normally going to be the web server that unescapes this. And the unfiltered attack is passed back. And you can see there, we've got some script alert that lands in, you know, a name value pair, and the value is foo, and then we've got our double quote to escape. So that's pretty boring. Let's go to this. So what does this look like? And this is something, this is actually just as simple. Mathematically, these attacks are not complex at all. They're actually very simple. And if you understand math and all the representations of hexadecimal, which is base 16, decimal is base 10, octal is base 8, right? All this stuff is completely derivative. So every format, and we don't have time to go into like a deep dive into the RFCs, but basically all these encoding types are very similar. If any of you have done like network protocol, like packets, reverse, you know, analysis, reverse engineering, if any of you used hex editors back in the day, like disk editing to, you know, crack software, it's all the same thing. You just have many different representations. And when we get on the web, the thing that's insane is the representations start getting exponentially more complex. There's dozens and dozens. So again, like I mentioned, C-like syntax. There's also HTML entities. People don't realize there are multiple HTML entities, and there's multiple variants of them. So this is one variant of decimal entities. So I have my script alert, and then I do decimal encoding, right? Doesn't look that sexy. There's at least 3 to 4 ways I can do decimal encoding that will be interpreted by most modern web browsers. Then I'm going to take that decimal encoding, and I'm going to URI escape the whole thing. Why? Because in this example, the web app server, they unescape the hex URI encoding, which you saw. Then the app server, or some library that's an intermediary interpreter, actually is going to normalize the decimal. So it's actually going to decode the decimal, and it's going to pump this back out so I get my raw value back out to the browser. And that's a simple way to do cross-site scripting. We can do many permutations, and we're going to do a live demo. Actually, I'm going to skip through these. The cross-site scripting is the easiest one to show, and you can actually, some interpreters will interpret different pieces of your attack encoded. So I'm going to show you a partially encoded attack that lands at an interpreter. I'm going to encode all the pieces that are relevant to bypass the filters and blacklists I have on my own website. I'm going to show you how to hack my own website. And we're going to actually land the payload in there. But we actually started doing SQL injection this way. And this is actually really fun. So I've got my basic SQL injection attack. So whatever I've got to select from, I've got, you know, drop table users. You know, that's really fun to do if you, you know, got an application where you don't like people logging on. So take your basic SQL injection attack, and most of us have used SQL injection tools that have different ways to encode it. Any modern mature SQL injection tool is going to have the relevant char functions. And in this case, I've taken the char function syntax that's going to work on MySQL. Now, you know, Microsoft SQL Server is going to be different, and Formix is going to be different. I'm not sure about Oracle. I'm syntactically possibly different. You know, some use comma values, etc. But we're going to represent our attack. We're going to use a native function of the database to represent our attack. And you know, in this case, it's a SQL injection, so we represent that. And this is actually not very new and not very sexy. But in this case, our application, the web app firewall, doesn't allow parentheticals in. It doesn't allow any database native functions. It could be a cast. It could be, in this case, I'm using a char. So we're going to URI escape the whole thing. So basically, our request response, or our request pairing, looks like this. We've got the char functions. And what's really interesting, so the web app server will unescape the hex URI, and this will actually land in the database. When that char function hits the database, it's going to concatenate and interpret it if it's vulnerable to SQL injection. Well, in this case, maybe we have blind SQL injection somewhere. We find this often. Black box, sometimes it's really hard to find blind SQL injection, figure out where it is. Well, in these cases, I don't care, right? What I really want to do is I want to launch cross-site scripting, HTTP response splitting, I want to do content spoofing and injection, and I want to do it using SQL injection. I don't care where the blind SQL injection is, I'll figure that out later. So I use my char functions to create a GUID, and then after the GUID, I create my second order attack, my cross-site scripting, etc. It's very trivial to do. The char function builds up all the syntax. The GUID allows you to trace it back. And by double and triple encoding these, we can submit them to the web app. They'll bypass a web application firewall. They'll bypass input validation. The app server, well, the web server will unescape the hex URI. The web server will unescape the hex URI. The app server will canonicalize some other hexadecimal format. In this case, I've got semicolon delimited hex, and it's going to wind up with the raw char function, which hits the database. It'll canonicalize that down to my GUID or my raw HTML that'll get pumped back out to the browser in this example. So the final one, how are we doing on time?
20 minutes.
Oh, okay. All right. So, and this is actually a really fun and interesting one. I wasn't sure if we'd have time to get into this. Again, it's another syntax example. Hopefully by now, like ideally, if I wanted a really boring but accurate presentation, we'd go through all the RFCs, and I would show you all the variants of encoding. And I do the Ferris Bueller voice, and we'd walk through, and we talk about how base 10 works. We talk about how base 16 works, all these representations. Why do use semicolons? Why not to? You know, there's all these good reasons why to encode in different ways, why not to encode. When it comes to testing software, you have absolutely no idea when you walk into an application what you're going to find until you play around with it. You're going to have to explore and poke around. And this particular vulnerability, Amit Klein is actually not here, but a gentleman who probably a lot of you in the room know of, Amit Klein, wrote a white paper a while back called HTTP response splitting, which is really misnamed. It should be named HTTP control character injection. And from there, there's like 31 flavors of things you can do. And one of them is HTTP response splitting. It's actually one of the harder things to pull off. And so I, like many people, didn't understand that paper and wrote it off. And I was one of those people, actually. I read that, and I was like, I don't really fully understand this, so I'm just going to, like, put this under the rug, and we'll ignore this for a while. And it actually was one of my customers a while back. I had a client that sent me an example, and I was like, this is totally trivial. You can't do anything interesting. And someone sent me an example. It was actually a customer of mine. It was really embarrassing. And they were like, well, I can set a cookie. I could override a cookie. And I was like, oh, you can. That actually does work. So what could we do with this? So in this example, this is just silliness, right? We're going to set an arbitrary header, arbitrary cookie, doesn't matter. If you're not familiar with so-called HTTP response splitting, basically think of it as cross-site scripting plus. So once you're into the header, you can do cross-site scripting, anything else you want. It's cross-site scripting plus. So this example, we're going to get into the header. And so here I have my foo, I have my carriage return line feed, I've got this example, blah, blah, blah. I've got it URI escaped, and I'm going to get back. Hopefully my slide animations will make up for my... So I'm going to skip that since we're short on time. So, you know, here's an example, and this is a crazy one. This we actually found in real production software. And I was really excited because I work with probably a lot of you have heard of and know Jeremiah Grossman, much smarter than me, much friendlier. And I work with him, and we got this bet going about canonicalization about a year and a half ago, I think. And Jeremiah told me that if you ever find a triple encoding under these conditions, the problem's too hard, none of us are going to solve it, I quit, I'm done. And I was like, rock, I get his job, right? So I set out to do that. Yeah, I really didn't know if this stuff would work, right? I'm just like, we're going to find this. So we actually found a triple encoding that was absolutely ridiculously insane in a financial application used by one of the biggest banks in the world now today. And it was totally fun and bizarre. So basically, they took in data, and they play the "we're smarter than the hacker" game. So they've got their blacklists, and they've got their input validation. They don't take in any meta characters. You know, they don't even take slashes in. They don't have greater than, less than. But they don't do output encoding. They don't do protocol normalization. They're too cool for that. They've got blacklists, so they catch things like JavaScript directives. Or if you want to get really crazy and funky, well, actually, they didn't do this, but you know, you get on that list. I found blacklists that like filter out like Mocha and LiveScript. Like, I don't think there's a lot of browsers. Maybe my mother uses one that still supports Mocha, but you know, anyway, we come into this application. And it takes in data, and if you URI escape everything, that's pretty cool. But the web server unescapes the URI encoding, and then it hits the app server, which has all its filters and whatnot, and it gets the raw data, and it looks at it, and it's like, okay, this isn't cool. We'll dump this. What was interesting was one particular application actually understood Base64. It was cool with that because, like many people, they would Base64 encode their cookies. Base64, especially Base64 FS2, is file system safe. So you don't have to worry about normalizing it. You can throw in a different file system, you can make it persistent. So this application understood Base64, but the cool thing is it wouldn't Base64 encode if you already did it. So we took our attack and we do our Base64 encoding of this, and then we URI escape it. The application would take this in, and then it would set it in a cookie. And it would read that cookie back out later. It would pull it through JavaScript space because that data had your username. So once you could target the name value pair with your username, it would be like, hey, welcome, Arian. Thanks for, you know, using blah, blah, blah online, right? So it would read this back out, and it would decode the Base64 into the document. So long and short, your attack, you would take your original attack, you would Base64 encode it, you'd URI escape it, and there was actually one more intermediary layer that gets even more complex. We're actually going to use decimal encoding, and I'm going to show you this in a live example here in about 1 minute. So you have URI escaping, you have Base64, and then you have decimal encoding, and it would interpret all of that. We find this, again, all the time. There are edge cases, no doubt, but if you remember the stat sheet, even though there's edge cases, there's a lot of them. That thing is pages and pages long. Some are 1, 2, 3, 4, some are, you know, 90-some examples. So I'm going to, before we wrap up, let's go and look at, how are we for time?
12 minutes.
12 minutes, okay. I should probably leave time for questions, but it'll probably be safer if I don't let any of you ask any questions. So we'll... All right, let's take, oh, you can't see this. So I've got, basically I'm going to take some strings here, and we're going to take an example of a JavaScript directive. I filter JavaScript very heavily on my site. So I've got here, that's too small to see. How do I make that bigger? There we go. Can I drive from here? Okay. So in this case, I'm going to take a simple JavaScript directive. And what I'm going to show you in live software, I have a demo app that we're going to walk through that you could do response splitting. And we don't necessarily have time to do that today. But that demo app we're going to publish on the web. So if you want to play with this and get an idea how to feel it out, the demo app does single decoding, it does double decoding, it does layered decoding. You can walk through all these examples. You can even do response splitting through cookies. It's actually very simple and easy to use. It looks like this. You just submit your forms and you can... looks like that. It'd be cooler if you could actually see it. So it's basically, we've got a series of feedback forms, and then we've got a thing that tells you you won a prize, and totally cool. But let's go back to... So in this case, I've got a JavaScript directive, and I'm going to take this JavaScript directive, and I filter these out. So anything that even looks or smells like JavaScript, I strip out of my application. So I'll take a body background here, and you, hopefully you can all see. So I've got a basic HTML tag. Now, I allow a very limited subset of HTML on my site. There are places where if you sign up as a user and want to customize, skin, do something, okay, fair enough. I'll allow you to suck in a body background. What do I allow in there? I do not allow you to supply arbitrary JavaScript. I'd be kind of dumb. I mean, it might make for a more fun application, but... you know, knowing a lot of you people, not a smart move. So in this case, I'm taking my arbitrary JavaScript and I'm going to decimal encode it. But that still won't work because in this particular name value pair I'm going to submit it, I don't actually want arbitrary HTML. Now, if you encode that the way most people or tools will do, they're only going to escape the meta characters. If you only escape the meta characters, the greater than, the less than, the double quotes, that sort of thing, like I'm still going to flag that there's an HTML tag. I'm still going to see there's a body tag there and pull it out. But it's actually completely much simpler. So we're going to take, I'll take this decimal example, and we'll take Windows. You have no idea how freaked out I was right before this presentation because I could not get... Windows to work for me. Okay. Control V. There we go. All right. We can see we've got our silly URI escaped example. And maybe Black Hat website not going to let me out to internet. It's right here. Yeah, I'm trying to scroll. Ah, there we go. All right. That's really cool, right? We got an alert box. I'm sure probably none of you So you've all seen the alert box, right? It's actually a very dangerous hack. And luckily today, most web application firewalls look for an alert function and they block it. Now, the sad thing is, I'm hearing a lot of laughter, because that's a really lame joke. But it's lame. It's really lame. And it's lamer that you all get it. But what's even lamer, it's a lame joke, you get it, you're laughing, which is humoring me, I'm cool with that. What's even lamer is you don't realize that we're actually running into that, right? I mean, I think the most recent thing, I don't know if we showed you this, we're finding people and we're finding web app security controls that are blocking XSS. We're finding people that are running their scanners, and they're scanner safe now because they're filtering out these dangerous strings. And I'm not kidding you. Like, it's that bad. So, all right, what does this really look like since I've never figured out how to use a hotkey and IE to view source? So we see here, we've got our URI escape stuff, right? And I've got my error. I'm throwing, oh, yeah, I've got a try-catch method. We're not going to load that module because you were doing something dangerous. But this is actually in use in the federal government and a few places. Let's go. All right. That was probably the wrong string to search for. So you can see here, this is what's actually landing. So what is important about this is that we can't see it. Let's go for... Can you see that now? Are we getting closer? All right. That's great. Notepad, I love it. So evidently, by changing font, you can protect yourself from these sorts of attacks, and it's actually a pretty robust mechanism here. Notepad, wave of the future in web app sec. So you can all see it there. Now, what is interesting about this attack is I found that in certain cases of interpreters, this is the same with databases, as with web browsers, as asynchronous message queues. Not all of your attack has to be encoded. Not all of your attack has to be canonicalized to raw form. You can actually have mixed parts. The key is to figure out what. So if you're doing SQL injection, basically your verbs and your keywords, and when you're doing web attacks against the browser, your verbs and your keywords are typically your raw HTML, if you need raw HTML. Or if you're injecting a style sheet, you need a style equals, you need your attributes, your basic part of the attribute, to be raw and canonicalized. All your payload can actually be encoded in a variety of formats. It depends on the browser interpreter. Same with the database. You have your select from, it needs to understand the raw verbs. The rest of it can be encoded. And actually, if you're not even doing a select, again, the examples I gave earlier, you can actually do cross-site scripting, HTTP response splitting. You can do this. I won't tell you the syntax, and hopefully you won't figure it out. You can do SQL injection on my own website if you know the right syntax for the database by building up char functions in the right way. And you have to encode them. And Again, I won't tell you how, and I know my website's not going to be up tomorrow morning. I probably shouldn't be explaining this, but anyway, so you've got your body background. You see the decimal payload. The browser's actually interpreting that. Okay, we're 5 minutes. I can dig into more live demos. So let me just do this. We have 5 minutes left. I can walk through live demos through the application. They're going to be just different variants of the same thing. I can actually walk through more slides as well. Mathematically, it's all going to be the same thing. It's going to be a syntax attack. And the first step is I'm going to interpret it. I'm going to encode it in a manner that will be either interpreted or canonicalized by my target parser. That's step one. Step two is I'm going to encode it in as many ways possible that will be interpreted along the way there. My final step is I'm going to encode it in a manner that's safe for the protocol. In this case, I'm doing URI escaping. So I'm going to layer these encoding attacks together, and I'm going to layer these encoding attacks together. They're going to get canonicalized and decoded in a variety of ways. I don't have any magic answers. I would love to tell you, well, if you do X, then Y, it's going to work for you all the time. That's what's really cool about these, is it's probably not going to work all the time. You're going to have to play with variants. And what I do, my simple strategy, is I have literally dozens and dozens of strings and different functions native to interpreters, and I have them encoded once, twice, three times. We submit them, and we see what comes out, and we're in the application. When we see them come out in a different form than we submitted them, we know something's going on, right? So that tells us, okay, let's dig in and see how deep the rabbit hole goes. So now to wrap up, I would like to do my final slide here, and then we're going to do question and answer or more demos, depending on what you want. We'll do a hand raise. So exposure to non-canonical syntax attacks. They're really tough to detect. Obviously, once you normalize for the protocol for different app servers, like, it's really tough to flag this stuff with IDS, IPS, with WAFs. The WAF vendors say they drop things that aren't canonicalized properly or are multiple encoded. I'm not seeing it happen. I know they're probably doing something. These make ideal targets for the bad guys because when you find these, I promise I'd tell you why, they're normally in functions wired into something very specific. Like, you go to your international wires application, and when you go to transfer money, the libraries that are wired in to support the international code pages, we ran out of time for the Hebrew example. Mitigation, the usual stuff. Strong data typing, output encoding, enforce a data function boundary. That's really generic. You should do that everywhere. It's best practices because mostly I don't have a good answer for you. Forensics, finding these after the fact is going to be very challenging. And actually, before our cool final slide, I want to throw in one more thing. And let's see if I can. All right. So this is one of the examples which we didn't get to go through in the live demo app, but this is a case of, it was a Hebrew. You have different Unicode code pages. Hopefully most of you understand how this works. So UCS 590 is the Unicode code page for Hebrew. So they support many applications, online dating. I've seen this many times now. They actually normalize across multiple code pages for full text searching. But the crazy thing is they're normalizing meta characters. So when you get into this application, you actually, they strip out greater than, less than, double quotes, etc. And so a friend of mine brought this to my attention. He's like, I think this is really screwed up. He was one of the developers that worked on it. He's like, I think this is really screwed up. Could you look at it for me? And I go and look at it, and sure enough, UCS 0520 through 0524 actually get normalized to meta characters like single quotes for SQL injection, like double quotes. So you can see up there your representations. So you can actually go in and structure your attack in Hebrew. It gets stored in the database. It gets normalized. It gets sucked back out later and presented to the user, or it gets built up in dynamic queries. So you've got international transcoding, and I've had people, since I've been here at Black Hat, showing them this silly example and talking about this. People have been laying out more and more and more they're seeing. You're not going to find this with most automated scanners. You're probably not going to find this through source code review unless you have a notion of metadata and know what you're looking for. You're going to have to actually go in and explicitly go in with a context and a notion of what is my application doing, how is it transcoding across multiple code pages. Again, from the beginning, when I laid out your order, find out what car sets, what code pages, find out what's supported. You need to map all those out and understand what you're going into the app. Then you need to take strings, you need to encode them. in various ways, like taking the Hebrew, you need to throw it in, and I would see the Hebrew, I could find my own strings come out in full text searches, but they were normalized to UCS 000 and 001, which is US Latin ASCII, and I was like, well, that's really kind of weird, like, what can we do with that? So you absolutely will have to go in on your own and do that, and so now I will I'll take questions, and if we're probably out of time.
You have about 14 seconds for questions.
All right, does anybody have a 14-second question?